I'd like to welcome you to the Modern Urologist. This is Todd Cohen from Myriad Genetics here with Mr. Alan Winkler, who is the Executive Director of Urology San Antonio. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely.
I want to dive right into this with you and a couple of issues that that you've dealt with. And one of them is a conversion of your EHR system that you did. And I know a lot of groups are terrible, a whole variety of reasons, one of which is loss of productivity and, of course, cost. So could you just tell me how that went for you, from why you did it and how it went?
Absolutely. We were on a product that was being sunsetted. So we had a limited time frame to close out our previous EMR. We looked at a couple different products. We ultimately chose iSalus. They have a product called EuroChoice. We started that by forming an EHR committee, but structuring it using, we have a full-time automation engineer. So we have someone in-house who actually oversaw the implementation team.
Why iSalus? What stood out with that as compared to some of the other systems that you looked at?
iSalus had the ability to customize templates, but not in a traditional format, just of the physicians clicking a lot of different boxes. They had the ability to actually integrate clinical pathways. And we have about 75 clinical pathways around most of the urologic disease processes. We've developed those pathways with our advanced practice providers working with their collaborative physicians.
You just opened up this huge can for me to ask you more questions, but keep going, because okay. I'm going to go on that with you.
Well, because iSalus had the flexibility to allow us to structure those templates, we selected four primary physicians, two that were the main drivers, who then worked to develop the individual templates. We solicited input along the way from all of the physicians in the group, partners and non-partners. We tried to structure those around those clinical pathways. So if a patient complains of hematuria, you click that, it opens up to the next level so that the physicians were not wasting time clicking boxes that didn't apply to the chief complaint. And they were still capturing the pertinent clinical information.
Did you guys develop the templates for that?
We did. We desperately wanted to not be the ones developing the templates, right. But we developed the templates.
Did you have a team of docs doing that, or is it just this four?
Yeah, we had really those four primary physicians, and then those physicians were assigned different sections of or different disease processes. And then they worked with two or three other physicians in the group to develop the content. And then the content was then shared back with the larger group. Within that, the structure of the implementation team included everyone from the front office supervisors. We had individuals who were the leads from our clinical pods, as well as our clinic managers. Our director of clinical programs was involved. Our ultrasound techs were involved. We had everyone involved in his or her appropriate section. Because of that, we ended up with a truly integrated system. One of the unique things about iSalus's EuroChoice is that they never tack on solutions to their existing product. They actually go back to the original source code so that everything is fully integrated.
Now I'm going to ask you this question.
Sure.
You may or may not know this. What is it an enterprise level database, or is it that you know of?
No, it is. It's all web-based. Okay. It's an enterprise database that's unique to each customer.
Okay.
Each of the customers has access to other templates as examples or forms and items like that.
You could theoretically share your templates with another group that is on
iSalus
as well.
Exactly.
They're transportable.
Exactly. Okay. So when we built that out, we then set up a specific timeline, a project timeline, and we stayed true to it. iSalus held us to the timeline, but we held ourselves accountable. And so from the time we signed the contract to go live was 5 months.
What were the biggest pain points in this?
I think the anxiety was actually the biggest pain point.
Yeah, I'll put that up there. Change.
It was change. Everyone knew that the other product was being sunsetted. So we knew we were on a tight timeline. We knew we had no choice. We had to move to another product. So that actually helped with the buy-in. As we were going through the training, we actually trained the staff before we trained the physicians. So other than the four primary physicians who were building the templates, the others were not involved along the way. By the time we had the physician training, their staff members had already been introduced to the product, had been had an opportunity to really play on the product, and they kind of knew what the plan was. So by the time we brought the physicians in for training, it was focused training that had been built around our specific workflows.
One of the fears or the anxieties involved is always, you know, loss of productivity over a period of time. Did you guys see that?
We actually planned for it. We went live on November the 12th of 2018. For the first 2 weeks, we reduced our physician templates by 50%. The physicians see 18 patients in the morning, 18 in the afternoon. So we went from 18 to 9 for 2 weeks. Then we went from 9 to 12 for about 3 weeks. By the end of 6 weeks, we were back at 18.
And did you see any glitches with, I mean, there's some always technical glitches, but from the doctor side of things, did it work pretty well? Everybody was up and up.
It worked well. It worked quite well. Lab is always the big stumbling block. And we actually decided that we wanted all of the lab integrated through a central lab information system. So we actually took even our referenced lab, the lab that we have to send out to LabCorp or Quest, and we actually send it also through our lab information system, which is LabDAC. Consequently, we had to structure a lot of work around that initiative that was actually not part of the EMR transition, but it needed to be in place.
So your labs, regardless of where they're done, all get integrated into the system?
Everything is electronic. Nothing is paper.
That's terrific. Now I want to go back to the comment you made about that you have, I think you said 75 different processes. Tell me, you know, that's always seems to be around the country a big sticking point in groups, is they have trouble developing these processes or protocols, whatever you want to call them. And how did yours go, and how did you get to 75, where most groups can't get past 01?
I don't know that it was a secret sauce, but the way we got there is we excluded the physicians from the process initially.
Smart move.
So we have advanced practice providers, some very talented nurse practitioners and physician assistants. They have a quarterly project that's required. So they were responsible for going and checking NCCN guidelines, AUA. They would compile that together, then work with their collaborative physician to validate it. And then we would bring it back to the group for any last minute tweaks. So we ended up with adoption from the physicians really from the beginning. That tool has been especially helpful as we've expanded our advanced practice provider contingent in the group, because as new apps are joining us, they actually have a resource library that's unique to this group.
That's really something. How many do you have?
We have 8 advanced practice providers, and we added those beginning in 2012. Our first was in 2006, but we really started expanding that in 2012. And we did that primarily because our physicians had such established patient panels, they didn't have new patient openings. So we did that to offload some of the established patients. Our apps do not see new patients.
And I think most people at first, I think the thought was, the patients are coming here to see me. They don't want to see an advanced practice provider. But I think in reality, it's they want to be seen. And they know that if they're there, it's truly an extension of their doctor. So that fear is not really realized. I learned that pretty quickly.
I agree. And what we have found is that the physician is the key to fostering that sense of confidence in the advanced practice provider. Right. So the physician on the patient's first visit brings the advanced practice provider in and introduces him or her to the patient, and introduces that person as, this is my partner in care. They're going to help take care of you.
Right. And then it almost inevitably comes out where the patients would rather see the advanced practice provider than the
Unfortunately,
doctor.
that has been true in a couple of instances. But I think that there's been general adoption. This group always has had a mature attitude towards the use of advanced practice providers. So there's been, the physicians have respected the position even before we had individuals slotted into it.
I'm going to go back a little bit to the process creation. How do you get adoption? You get the process put out there, and how do you see it and I'm sure it's different in different processes. Mm-hmm. And what do you do to maintain physician compliance with these processes, or how do you gauge it?
The processes become standardized through a couple of different approaches. One is we have a general meeting of all of the physicians, all of the advanced practice providers, and the administrative team on a monthly basis. 80% of that meeting is clinical. So they're walking through the clinical pathways. They're talking about specific instances where they've of specific patients. And so consequently, what we found in our group is through repetition, you can, if you're going to have an OAB pathway rolled out, you bring the OAB team before that group three or four times in sequential meetings. And by about the third or fourth meeting, the group gets it. And they've signed off on it. They feel like they've had input on it. And so it helps standardize the care as well.
Do you have to go back and look at compliance, or do you go back and look at compliance?
This group is structured around a culture of collegiality. And we have far more carrots than we have sticks. And where we actually look at compliance is through our quality and compliance committee. And we're doing that retrospectively. And only when we see large variations do we have those conversations. And those conversations actually happen between the group's medical director, who's also a member of the board, and that individual physician. We never bring that to the entire group unless we see that it's a group issue.
So there's no public shaming.
There's no public shaming. However, we do educate physicians in a public manner.
Okay, so.
So for example, if we see that they're allowing cases not to, cases that are appropriate for the surgery center to somehow leak over to the hospital, we do bring those back. And so we monitor, for example, on a monthly basis, of all of the cases appropriate for the surgery center, what percentage of that physician's cases were done at the surgery center. And simply by educating them, we've actually been able to change behavior.
It's amazing because, you know, most practices, you know, throughout the country, you'll probably hear that the stick is much more valuable than the carrot. But you know, kudos to you guys to be able to, but that, you're right. It's a cultural thing. It definitely is. And it depends on the culture of the group, and everybody's culture is a little different.
Yes.
And before I go on, for, you know, kind of change the subject a little bit, I do want to say I loved you in Happy Days. And even much better in Barry recently.
Yeah, thank you so much.
But what happened with Waterboy?
Yeah.
That was one of your worst.
Well, that's why I'm in medical practice administration now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think the rest of the audience would probably agree with me when they look it up. But moving on. Now, I know that you guys have a very robust research division. Mm-hmm. And I want to get into that, but just, and I want to put that on the back burner for a second and let you think about it. But you have something unique that I've seen around the country, and that is a true pharmacy, as well as DME or and cath, specifically catheter distribution here. You know, when did that occur, and why did you do it that way?
We added the catheter division in 2013. Our physicians wanted to expand the continuum of care with the patients, and it seemed like a natural piece of that patient's care. The patients have the right to go anywhere they want to. We send the script anywhere the patient would like. However, what we found is that the patients appreciate the in-house education that they get, the personal attention that they get from our catheter division. And we're currently servicing about 425 patients a month.
Who do you work with, and how did that get started? I mean, from an operation standpoint, this is something that most groups don't do. So I think a lot of people would be curious to listen to this, and I could picture a few people sitting there furiously taking notes on this. So, mm-hmm. You know, how did you operationalize that?
We stumbled a lot in the early days.
Fair enough.
And we really had to find someone who was experienced in running a specialty pharmacy, specialty DME type environment, who understood the rules that we needed to follow. We've automated the process. So
is this tied into Isalis as well?
Everything is tied back into the EMR. Okay. And so the orders are placed from the EMR. Even if the patient wants to use an outside company, the orders are still placed inside the EMR. The difference is that if the patient uses our service, obviously our DME staff has full access to the patient's medical record. So whatever the insurance needs, we're able to provide in a much more timely manner. And so we track patient satisfaction very closely, both in our DME service and in our pharmacy. So far, it's gone well. DME is often misunderstood because it's paid by the by Medicare's DME division. Mm-hmm. However, it's actually a prosthetic supply because it's not durable medical equipment. And so it's paid under a different type of Medicare benefit. And so there's a lot of misinformation out in the marketplace.
And this is where people will get confused and, you know, have trouble, right, and probably get frustrated. Since yours can tie into your EHR system, that's mm-hmm. a huge benefit.
Yes, it is.
And all right, now I want to go back to the research thing. Very sure. robust program. You were talking, you know, earlier that you have 15.
We average 15 to 20 clinical trials at any one time. We started, most of those were centered around prostate cancer, and certainly under the leadership of Dr. Dan Saltzstein. Since that time, we've been able to expand that to include some medical device trials as well. With all of the changes in bladder cancer, we're branching out into bladder cancer as well now. And so we have a lot of resources that are devoted to that research division. Again, the physicians in the group see that as an extension of the continuum of care.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so with the protocols that we have in place, through a variety of, we have, for example, one of our advanced practice providers is an expert in hereditary cancer. So she provides some very valuable input. Our physicians and the other advanced practice providers, we really subspecialize in prostate cancer. So we have four primary physicians who are subspecializing in that area. So they're the ones who are making the decisions on genomic testing as well as kind of that clinical pathway. Having the clinical trials division allows us to have an option for the patients after the traditional medications have failed.
No, I think it's great because you don't have to send them off to an academic center.
Right.
And the patients aren't comfortable. Usually when I would have to send somebody off to a medical oncologist at an academic place, the patient felt like there was no hope. Because you're giving up on me, so you have to send me up. So having it in-house takes a lot of that anxiety.
It does, and I think having a clinical pathway also facilitates that conversation with the patient, because you can, on paper, you can show the patient, okay, here's where you are in this pathway. Here are all the other things that we still can do for you.
Yeah, so if this doesn't work,
we have other options. And sometimes the patients don't hear that there are other options. They hear they have cancer,
right,
and they panic, and then they worry. In this instance, we actually have the ability to reach out to business partners who provide valuable input, like Myriad. And then we can educate those patients and provide the patients with all the resources that they need. We have nurse navigators also on staff. So we have nurse navigators around prostate cancer, OAB, BPH, and soon bladder cancer. So we actually have a personal connection between this practice and the patient, in addition to the connection that the physician provider has
established. I'll ask you a little bit more about research, then I'm going to get into, since this is such a nice conversation, I want to get a little bit more into your navigation thing as well. On the research, how is it structured? You have the four doctors that are very involved. What other components do you have? Imagine research coordinators and things like that. How is it structured?
We have a director of research who really is working with finding the opportunities, negotiating the budgets. We have got...
So you keep the doctors away from that part.
Well, the doctors want to be kept away from that part in most of the instances. The principal investigator obviously is involved in that aspect. But we also have care coordinators and those case coordinators for each of the studies. And those individuals actually are going into our clinics. We have 8 different locations. And so they're going face-to-face with the patient. And so we try to make the personal link there, and that actually helps with compliance with follow-up.
And do the coordinators, are they mining who's coming in and who may be eligible for these, or how do you best identify patients eligible?
We identify patients for a couple of different ways. We have a data analytics tool that we use for our nurse navigation. So that will automatically pull quite a few of those patients out.
Which one do you use?
We're using PPS Analytics.
Yeah, okay.
And then we also use other products like InfoDive to extract the data. When it comes down to some of the intricacies of clinical trials, because you've got the inclusion and exclusionary criteria, because of the specificity with that, we often use our advanced practice providers, and we provide them with a list of kind of a core list of patients. They then literally work through the charts and find the appropriate patients.
Yeah, I found that was the only way. It has to be manual.
It ends up being manual just because each study is unique.
Yeah, I imagine that. Do you have your navigators involved in?
We do have the navigators. The navigators are really the ones who are driving the PPS analytics piece. Okay. So they're driving the communication with the patient and communication back with the physician. And then we've overlaid that with our chronic care management program so that we have another point of contact with the patient who's having a lot of conversations during the month about activities of daily living, as well as kind of compliance with medication. And then all of that ties back into our pharmacy, because we have two pharmacists who are working in conjunction, certainly on those oncolytics.
So you're also doing another service line is the chronic care management?
We have chronic care management. We're actually tapping into ISALIS for that as well.
Okay, so they're helping you with that?
They have a division that actually manages that piece of it. And then they are documenting directly into the ISALIS chart. So when a physician or a nurse practitioner goes into the patient's chart, all of the information is in one location.
That's fantastic. I know that was something that we were looking to implement as well. It's very labor intensive, though.
It is.
If you don't have a partner.
No, it truly is.
So, listen, I want to thank you. You offered a tremendous amount of insight and valuable information for other administrators. But I don't think anybody that I've talked to, or very few people I can say around the country, are as well oiled as what you've created here. So I want to
I appreciate that, but the credit goes to the physicians in this group. We have a truly phenomenal group of physicians who enjoy practicing together and enjoy taking care of patients.
Again, that's very unique as well.
I agree.
Yeah, so I want to thank you again, and thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Appreciate it.